I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. You know, an institution is really impressive when people come to believe that it has always been there. It's always been with us. The origin of the thing goes back to the beginning of time. I'm talking about venerable institutions like the Smithsonian or the Vatican or maybe something like the Iowa State Fair or maybe that tedious annual event that's sponsored by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. You know what I'm talking about. These things just go back to the dawn of time. And at the opposite end from having no beginning is the conceit that something will never end, like Lehman Brothers, which actually did end in 2008. How about the Roman Empire, Toys R Us? The show must go on, they say, but Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus did not go on. Well, today we are going to talk about the highly esteemed, much anticipated annual event that has been with us since the dawn of time. It's called the Tour de France. It's a bicycle thing. And even though bikes aren't all that old, if we're thinking about geologic time, it still seems to me that the Tour de France has been with us forever, except when it wasn't, because actually it went away and then came back. Actually, the race has had two hiatuses like this, each connected with a world war. We are going to be focusing on the earlier of the two stories with writer Aidan Dobkin. Aidan Dobkin is a journalist whose writing has appeared in The Atlantic, the Los Angeles Review of Books, Catapult, the Paris Review, New York Times Magazine, and elsewhere. And today we're visiting with him about his book, Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. Aidan Dobkin, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, my very first question to you might strike you as a little bit cheeky, but I'm actually very serious about this. Can you bike? Do you bike? Do you like it? Or is this book something that maybe vicariously you're living through other bikers? You can fantasize about it. Where do you stand with bicycles?
I ride a bike pretty frequently. I grew up always riding them, and it's kind of my preferred mode getting through the city of New York where I'm at right now. But I certainly am not competitive, and the impetus of this story was as much the kind of setting and time as it was the actual event itself.
The setting including the place, because when you're bicycling around New York City, that's not like going through the French Alps.
Exactly.
Well, okay, where does this actually begin? Because I could just say World War I, but I've already alluded to the fact that things do have beginnings, and the Tour de France began when?
It began in 1903 with the kind of start of this new sports daily, Lotto, which was created by a conglomeration of advertisers that were kind of in the sporting industry, surrounding the sporting industry, and a former PR man for them, Henri de Grange. The newspaper was struggling at the time, and one of Henri's journalists that worked under him said, there are these newspapers who are sponsoring these single-day races or races around a track, but what about this an event that no one has really seen before, a stage race that would occur day after day, ultimately traversing the entire French border? And that's the start of the race, that this thing had never been done before. No one really knew what it would take, but these group of guys decided to try it and really push for it. And through persistence and luck and resources, they've been able to continue it most years up through the present.
So the story you just told me, somewhere in there, I detect this, that the Tour de France began as a publicity stunt for a failing newspaper.
Exactly.
That's not very flattering.
It is. You know, the bike race has this very vexing sort of history for those who closely follow it. Lotto was founded in response to the Dreyfus Affair, where a Jewish army officer in the French army was accused of crimes against France. And, this is a trial that erupted and really defined contemporary French society, or political society, at least in many ways. And L'Auto was founded to create a newspaper that, you know, would be mum on political issues. Now, that, of course, didn't wind up being true. And ever since, it's kind of had this mixed relationship to French history. In World War II, there were charges of collaboration with the then organizer, in addition to kind of the relationship it's had to its cyclists, who have been, you know, pushed well past a breaking point in some instances. And it's really bound up in so many issues of contemporary French society, as well as, you know, labor, economics, politics, and not always in flattering ways. I think it's something that a Tour de France fan has to reckon with, and which I really at least attempted to do in this book, is provide an understanding of the race in the society that it's most intimately involved with, rather than just this grand inspiring event that it is at sometimes, but it also exists in this kind of network of issues that are less frequently talked about.
Yeah, so you're saying that the race is much bigger than the race. The race is a cultural phenomenon much bigger than just the bicyclists on their cycles. It has symbolism.
Exactly. I mean, I think a perfect example is the fact that there is this thought among historians, and as far as I know, it's at least partly true, which is that, you know, prior to the Tour de France, people who might have received not a full life's worth of education wouldn't have really understood the shape and relationship between various places in their country before they received L'Auto in advance of that year's bike race and saw, okay, the race is heading through my town on this day, and before that and after that, we're connected to these places, and all in all, it forms the shape of this country that we are a part of and changing, as you know, we see
in
the course of 20th century history.
You're actually saying that this race had a big hand in achieving some kind of national solidarity for the French people.
Exactly. And you know, just a very basic sense of geographic education.
Okay. I guess geographic education and emotional solidarity might be cohere. You know, there might be something there. Did the race survive the newspaper? Is the newspaper still with us? What happened to L'Auto?
L'Auto floundered and was kind of received an inglorious end at the end of World War II, when its editor at the time was brought up on charges of collaboration. It's a little bit of a complex scenario, as is many of these kind of big political events that, you know, correspond to various dates in the tour's history. But what wound up happening is that L'Auto shuttered, and the editor managed to avoid being charged with collaboration, even though there was a trial. And so a new newspaper was started in its wake, L'Équipe, which is a newspaper that is still around these days. There is now an international sporting group that manages the race and many others, but L'Auto is no longer, it's kind of,
yeah,
some of its, you know, network is still there through L'Équipe, but after the end of World War II, its formal name died, at least.
Yeah. Behind my question, obviously, is the whole notion of somebody shepherded this whole – somebody gave birth to it, and then somebody took care of it, and then it got bigger than the sponsoring institution, and it just took off, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Henri de Grange took over – I mean, really started this newspaper alongside the advertisers. But as quickly as the tour became a recurring instance in French culture, Henri de Grange was no longer the editor of L'Auto. He was the father of the Tour de France.
Yeah. So how long – I mean, the story you tell does kind of zero in on this Henri de Grange. So he stays kind of in charge of this thing for a couple of decades maybe or so?
Yeah, he remains in charge with a direct hand on the race's management up through 1936, and then, you know, is forced to leave on account of surgery. But even in his final years between 1936 and 1940, still maintains a very intimate involvement with the individual who took over for him.
Yeah, so I said a couple of decades. We're talking over three decades plus.
Exactly. And it's really like the early tour and its shape is as much a function of his vision as anything else.
Well, let's talk about that hiatus. The war comes. It's not just the war. It's the Spanish flu pandemic that really wipes it out. I guess it goes black for 3-4 years.
Yeah, the last race before going on hiatus was 1914. It actually starts the same day that Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated, but they wound up continuing the race in spite of that, as, you know, is kind of a recurring theme in the Tour de France, and winds up not being canceled every year or never really even being organized. Up through 1918. And then as soon as armistice is declared in November of 1918, within 10 days of armistice being declared, there's an announcement in Lotto saying the Tour de France is back. So really as soon as they knew that they would have a country to ride through, they planned to host the race.
So all of us have been living through a time where some things have been interrupted by something called COVID. And I did mention the Spanish flu pandemic coincided with World War I. So we're familiar with the idea that some things, we want them to come back. You know, I think we can understand very well what it feels like to have something beloved taken from us that we want to continue, even if it just does, seems like, you know, superfluous entertainment for a lot of people. Is this what your story is about? It came back, and it came back remarkably quickly after the war.
This was a race that was, yes, about returning for so many people. And that is something that was one of the first interesting bits of knowledge, that kind of almost inherent knowledge that drove me to tell this story. And it's about how that returning intersects oftentimes with a land that has been utterly destroyed in a way that we certainly as Americans and certainly as contemporary Americans oftentimes, you know, simply cannot fathom. And so it was a question that rode through my mind throughout writing and researching this book was, you know, what does returning look like for these people? And for the cyclists and for the organizers, the organizers, it is a little bit of an easier question of why return. It's hard to fully separate the business and legacy interests that are involved. But for the cyclists, it was a question that drove through my mind was, you know, these are individuals who oftentimes were in uniform up until, you know, weeks before the race began. Sometimes the only reason that they were allowed to get out of uniform, at least at that exact moment, was to ride in the race. And that was a little bit of a more difficult question for me to fully unpack was, why is each individual riding in this, you know, sometimes dangerous, at least wildly uncomfortable and tiring race? And it's in some ways an impossible question to answer, but I did want to explore what it looks like to return in those first months after a devastating war in this very unique sort of event that is a sporting event, but also so much more than that, at least for the French people.
You know, along with war comes that economic devastation, and I just can't even imagine having the resource or the wherewithal to put this together or for individuals to participate, because it costs money, and you got to have a sponsor, or you got to find somebody's got to, you know, foot the bill for this. Do you think it happened prematurely?
The tour has always partly been about pushing these individuals to a sometimes grotesque degree. And this is just one other instance of that. It was a way to move past that time where they may no longer have been fighting, but they were still either, you know, taking part in drills, occupying, you know, various territories, or beginning the process of rebuilding, which was oftentimes really dark, disgusting work at the end of the fighting.
So maybe the race itself is so grueling that there's no point in putting it off. Yeah, because it's whether you've been through a war or not, it's going to be just incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and from the perspective of Henri de Grange, at least there is a popular quote attributed to him that, you know, his ideal version of the race is one cyclist makes it back to Paris, and that's the winner of the Tour de France that year. And so grueling and punishing courses were not a deterrent for him. It's a separate question of the cyclists and you know, this, I think particularly now, as we've seen the kind of relationship between athletes, fans, administrators, and the sports, people are questioning, you know, what is a healthy relationship between those entities look like? And that's so much of what drives the history of the Tour de France, too, is, you know, what is best for the cyclists, what is best for the Tour, what is best for the people who watch it, and, you know, gradually over time, can those things be in balance?
You know, I don't want to be too cynical about this, but it's kind of like in ancient Greece, the first runner to marathon drops dead after getting to marathon, right, and delivering his message. And that's spectacular and glorious and can be celebrated, you know, even if he died. Would you tell us what these bicyclists saw in 1919 as they made their round about through France? What did they see? I can only imagine they saw all the devastation that the country had suffered.
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, the early iteration of the Tour de France really traverses the entire border of the country. And so they start by heading to the northwest and riding down the coast, then hitting the Pyrenees and the Alps, and then, you know, making a quick stop in Geneva before they take on what had been the Western Front a few months before and is now kind of Zone Rouge, which is kind of a categorization of how devastated the land is based on shells that maybe hadn't been exploded and were still kind of sitting in the ground, trenches, craters, of course. And they're riding through these towns that essentially don't exist anymore. Some of the towns that they rode through on the final few stages before heading back to Paris, 90% of the buildings had been destroyed. You look at some of the pictures from this time, and it's incredible to see just the level of destruction, where you can tell something was once there because it's bricks and stuff on the ground, but it's so, everything else is gone. And this is what they were riding through in the final few stages, on ground that was absolutely, you know, treacherous for being more or less flat. You know, even in the better sections of the race that year, the French government had not been paying too much attention to the roads that, you know, weren't being used to carry various supplies to the front. And even those roads that were used to supply the front simply couldn't keep up with the various kind of machines that, you know, were never meant to really cross those roads. And now these cyclists on these simple machines are traversing the ground and with essentially zero assistance. That was a big part of the early races. A tour cyclist should be able to do it all. And if you can't repair your machine, then you're as good as someone who simply can't ride from one town to the next.
Oh, so there's no pit stop for you anywhere.
There are stops, but, you know, the tour rider is responsible for the maintenance of their machine. There's no kind of mechanic on staff. There's no second bike frame that you can swap out. A fork, you know, gets bent out of shape or something like that. It was all on the cyclists themselves to repair.
In a way, I wonder if the event to begin with wasn't still celebrating the success of the Industrial Revolution. You know, the bicycle was not that old an invention. People are still saying hooray for the bicycle. And so it's about the bike succeeding as well as the rider of the bike.
Yeah, we see this in how amateurs were integrated with professional cyclists in those early iterations of the race. If you or I wanted to hop on our bike and not only join the cyclists and ride along the route, but really compete in the race as equals, apart from the fact that we wouldn't be receiving salaries from sponsors, we could do so. And I think that gestures to the place of the bicycle in society and the particular way in which the Tour conceives and is integrated within French society and contemporary society at that time is the idea that, yes, it is a tool for athletic feats, but it's also a practical invention. You know, some of the cyclists who were there on the route that year only months before had been part of cycling units in the war, which rode to and from the front and were mechanics for those same cyclists. And so it is not this purpose-driven tool, but it is a means by which someone can convey themselves across greater distances than they otherwise might. And I think that is a real big change for particularly in a lot of these small towns.
You know, industrialization was supposed to foster egalitarianism. And so there's kind of like a socio-political statement in the whole thing.
Yeah, which of course, you know, is interesting to consider in light of the kind of labor questions of the Tour and how organizers pushed cyclists beyond what they had ever done before. In the 1924 race, there was an investigative journalist who followed the cyclists that year and wound up writing a couple stories about the race, and one of them is called The Tour of Suffering, and the other is kind of Convicts of the Route, or forced laborers or prison laborers of the roads. So yes, it is egalitarianism, and it is this flattening of the idea of an athlete that in theory skill is all it takes. A multi-purpose sort of skill that might include mechanics as well as powering yourself across alpine climbs. But, you know, it also comes alongside these questions of these are organizers who are kind of riding in cars along all day, kind of just deciding on a route year after year that they've never tested themselves. They just know that if they offer a proper fee or a prize, there's going to be some number of cyclists who take them on.
You have got to tell us the story about the bicyclist who was penalized for offering water to a fellow racer. We're going to do that after a short break here. Aidan Dobkin is with us. He is author of Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. Stay with us. Constant Wonder continues after this. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a pleasure to have Aidan Dobkin with us to talk about his book, Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. Yeah, a punishing race by all accounts, and it's been that way from the get-go, from when it was organized back in 1903, and then there's this hiatus for the First World War. And was it before or after the First World War when a racer was punished? He shared water with a fellow racer, and you're not supposed to offer any kind of support to a competitor.
Yeah, so quote-unquote cheating has occurred throughout the Tour de France from its first year in 1903. In 1904, they thought they might actually have to cancel the race because there was so much rampant cheating that they weren't sure how to certify the results. Now, the instance in question I write about in the book itself, it occurs in the first stage, but it gestures to this idea that Henri de Grange had of really as much as being good athletes, the Tour de France champion would be totally self-sufficient, would be able to repair his bike, would be able to take on these distances with the limited supplies he might have, or go into town and find some. And also gesturing to kind of the very particular set of rules that changed from year to year, but were always at the front of de Grange's mind and defined in many ways the experience of a cyclist in the race.
So what actually happens? Somebody is thirsty.
Someone's thirsty, and if they don't have any water, they need to ride into the next town and pay for some or get some from someone. And if someone, you know, if there's a long distance to the next town and they're riding alongside someone they know, they ask them for water. If that person gives it to them, the first penalty is 30 minutes for both of them, and then it's 2 hours if it happens again. And then on the third instance, they're kicked out of the race just for, you know, giving someone water, because it doesn't even, if to DeGrand or to the rules, it doesn't matter the nature of the assistance. It's just that if assistance is being done, it is the same penalty regardless.
I can hardly wrap my head around this, and I guess there's got to be rules for it. Was DeGrange heavy-handed in all of this? Do you think he could have backed off a little?
Yeah, he certainly was. I mean, we spoke earlier about, was this event premature? And plenty of people would say absolutely. Or, you know, if it was to happen, then an abbreviated version, you know, some version of the race that maybe still maintained some essence of the Tour, but maybe didn't go through the Northeast or those most dangerous or, you know, just destroyed roads. But to DeGrange, if it wasn't the full Tour, it wasn't anything. And that drove these small decisions, like how rules were implemented, and the larger decisions, like where the route took the cyclist. He was, you know, unsparing in his vision for the race, and anything short of that absolute vision was to him no longer the Tour de France.
Is there any truth to the story that among the cheaters was somebody who tried to poison somebody?
Yes, and I'm familiar with the details of the story, but there are poisonings. There are crowds of fans who stopped a cyclist going through a town and kicked him off his bike and were about to beat him up until the timekeeper and Henri DeGrange rode up into town and fired the starting pistol to break up the crowd. I mean, the very first years of the race in the 1900s, just some of the instances seem more like a movie or some sort of kind of Wild West notion of sports more than the very professional and you know, strictly maintained race we see today. People cheating by putting a cork between their teeth and tying a string and pulling someone behind them. Some of these schemes are absolutely wild and seem closer to a movie or some sort of farce than a professional sporting event.
Do you think if France has a Wild West today, it still is embodied in the Tour de France?
I think the race has changed significantly, and it's and as a function of that, it's hard to, I mean, apart from doping that, you know, we have obviously seen in contemporary, you know, Tour de France races, the Wild West nature of it is gone. I think there's too much money. The individual cyclist is less important now than they once were. It is more about international teams, large conglomerations of sponsors, and an international circuit that is supported by trainers and mechanics and all these people around the cyclists who make sure that all they have to do is just ride as hard as they can. And even the distances are shorter. And the race itself is, you know, even bigger than it was back then. It is now international in nature. Back in those first instances of the race, you had French, Belgian, Italian, some Spanish cyclists, eventually German, but the U.S. And even Great Britain aren't involved for decades. And that international nature of the Tour, I think, dilutes some of the, you know, uniquely French elements of it. Even though, you know, those who watch the race and are most closely involved with it in France still have those same associations to the race because of the route it takes through those tiny towns. But I think some of the Wild West elements are no longer there.
Well, let's talk last of all about that 1919 race, the first one to happen after World War I, and whether it was premature or not. And we know it was punishing. We know it was grueling. I'm wondering if the winner of the race had even greater glory attributed to him than other winners in other years. Tell us about the winner in 1919.
So the winner in 1919 was somewhat unexpected. Up through almost the final stage, one Frenchman by the name of Eugene Christophe led. He was someone who people were familiar with. He had been a competitor in the years before the war began, eventually fell in the 1913 race before, when it looked like that was the year that he might be able to win. And he's leading up through those final stages, but then suffers a catastrophic break in, I believe it was the second to last stage. And a Belgian by the name of Fermin Lambeau takes his place and winds up winning the race. Eugene is a mechanic, is someone who, by all accounts, is the optimal Tour de France winner, even though he is older than the average winner at that point. But he has to carry his bike into town, weld it back together, and set off again. And he does an admirable job, but it's not enough to keep the yellow jersey, which signifies the leader of the general classification. And so this Belgian by the name of Fermin Lambeau takes his place. And for glory for Fermin Lambeau is a little bit muted by the fact that he just took the place of this Frenchman that everyone thought was going to win, and in many ways kind of represented the French experience at that point. Had been a mechanic during the war and kind of a very practical sort of guy who took the off season to work as a mechanic and things like that. So for Fermin Lambeau, he wins the race. He wins the general classification, which is the Tour's main prize. But Eugene Christoph, even though he rides in no longer in first place, it's in many ways the most glory goes to him, in that immediately and materially people start sending in checks to Lotto's office just saying, give this guy some additional money. He winds up receiving more from individual donors than the Tour prize at that point. And so it's this interesting kind of muted and divided winner that year, in that there is a winner of the general classification and it is his name on, the Tour records. But Eugene Christoph, who didn't wind up winning, is in many ways the
folk hero, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, a folk hero. And the nationalistic aspect played into this because it was France against Belgium.
Yeah, which is another kind of common feature throughout the Tour, at least its early years, is that there are decisions being made about who's going to be invited to join the race and things like that, and to what degree people are celebrated based on how they're doing and where they're from. And that's difficult to separate from, at least up through World War II. It's difficult to separate that element of the race from the kind of pure sport that I think some people think of when they think about athletes generally, or at least, the Tour de France, is that, yeah, there is this very nationalistic element, not a purely negative nationalistic element, but there is a very close association based on the way the Tour de France is run with the kind of country itself. And that changes how people view who rides in the race and who gets invited and things like that, at least when Lotto and Henri de Grand were running it.
So if you're a guy who rides a bike through New York City and also a guy who wrote a book about the Tour de France and its history, there's got to have been those days when you were on your bike feeling a little bit of breeze around you and thinking about France. Did that happen to you?
There certainly have been those days. And I was fortunate enough to, try and recreate some of their route, not on bicycle, but in a small Peugeot when I was in the course of researching and writing it. And I, don't have the stamina they did. I certainly don't have the mechanical experience they did. But, when I tried to recreate those routes, which I was able to do because of very detailed itineraries, I was able to gather up just some of the scenes they would have witnessed. These are locations that haven't changed for hundreds of thousands of years. Others did in the Western Front, but some of those scenes earlier in the Alps and the Pyrenees were just staggering. And it was to imagine it on a less than modern road,
yeah,
where just on top of a bicycle with a few others around you, or perhaps no others if there was some distance between you. Just riding through some of those locations is, I would have to imagine, is incredible.
Aidan Dobkin, a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thanks for being with us and telling the story.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aidan Dobkin, a journalist. His writing has been in The Atlantic, in Catapult, in the Paris Review, and elsewhere. And we have been talking about his book, Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France.
The very first bicycles did not have wheels. No, they had wheels. They did not have pedals. And they were pretty fast going downhill. Not so much going uphill. A quick history of the bicycle when we come back to Constant Wonder. Stay with us. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Long before the automobile, long before the railroad became a thing in England, 1819 is the year the precursor to the modern bicycle first arrives in America. Without pedals, by the way, propelled by gravity and by the feet of the rider, in that respect a little bit like a skateboard, I guess. Within a few months, it was banned in New York City, and 200 years later, it is indispensable all over the world with pedals. Here's part of the conversation I had with Margaret Gurhoff. She's author of The Mechanical Horse, How the Bicycle Reshaped American Life.
People in America were building these based on drawings that had come over from Europe. And it was very heavy, made of iron and or wood. And you would straddle it and then kind of push off on the ground. There's a new fashion for teaching little kids how to ride a bike by putting them on these little glider bikes, which are like little two-wheelers push along with their feet, right? Well, this is basically a gigantic, heavy, iron version of that. They were very expensive. You had to be really strong to ride them.
I'm guessing it was good for downhill travel.
Exactly. I bet you would find a lot of them at the bottom of the hill. they were for people with country estates. But these were, even though they, to us, would seem very heavy and ungainly, at the time they were the first thing that could go as fast as a horse on land. You know, you could have a carriage, but that would go exactly as fast as a horse could pull it. And these, if you were going downhill, could actually go faster. So it was an amazing new experience for the people who were able to find them and ride them.
So basically this draisine had a couple of wheels and then something connecting the wheels with a seat. And it was heavy, and I'm guessing it was not a comfortable ride.
Well, it was fun. You know, it wasn't something that you would be able to go on a long trip on. It was very bumpy and very rigid. And you would, again, like we said, you know, if you got to the bottom of the hill, you would have to push it up the hill, which could be pretty heavy.
By the time you get to the penny farthing, it has spokes. And I think this draisine probably didn't have those wire spokes.
Correct. The draisine had wagon wheels, basically. Because they didn't know. Those spokes that you're talking about were a special kind of tension wires that allowed them to make those gigantic wheels staying round because of the tension of those spokes.
If it were made out of wagon wheels and were that large, it'd be very heavy indeed. I don't even know how you'd stay up. Well, I want to get into the use of a functional bicycle that kind of resembles what we have today. What did you call that thing that had pedals plus the chain?
Oh, so that's called a safety. Those come along right after the Civil War, and that's something that you could. I'm conflating two. So the ones that came right after the Civil War had the pedals, and they were low. And then they got big to go fast, and then the designers figured out how to put chains on them to create spokes and gears, and they were able to create that same amount of force as if it had a big wheel by turning the wheel several times for every time the pedals turned. That's what the chains and the gears were for. Those are called safeties, and they came along at the end of the 1880s. And at that point, the bicycle became something that was available to anyone to ride, not just a very strong person who was wearing pants, so it would mostly be a man who could get up on one of those big, huge safety, big, huge ordinary bicycles, the big wheelers.
There's some famous statement, now that you've mentioned men versus women on bicycles, something Susan B. Anthony had to say. She was an advocate for the bicycle because?
Because it gave women a kind of freedom of movement that they had never had before. So before there were bicycles, people who didn't have a horse and carriage could only get as far as they could walk, or they could take a streetcar somewhere once those were developed towards the end of the 19th century. But women, particularly, proper women who were of a certain social class, were expected to stay very close to home or only to go out with permission of their husband or their father. And once this bicycle came along, it became possible for women to go out under their own steam without needing to ask permission or borrow the carriage. And so Susan B. Anthony felt that it was something that had given women a vision of what it was like to be empowered and what it was like to, create their own destiny.
There are such curious chapters in this story, and you cover so many of them in your book. You talk at some point about resistance to the bicycle for a host of different reasons. What were the reasons? What were some of the reasons that people would have said, let's not pursue this? This is a problem, this bike thing.
Right. Well, I mean, what you had mentioned about women was a big part of it. There was it threatened the social order in that way. Women became able to go out by themselves, meet together, talk about shouldn't we have the vote, So it had that aspect. Also, it was considered a social equalizer. So when the first bicycles came, those big wheelers that we've been talking about, again, those were very expensive. So those were for people of means and people who were strong, so young businessmen. And they developed a culture of kind of hail fellow, well met. Like if you saw somebody else on a bicycle, you would know that they were of a certain social class and they were okay to talk to. But once the safety bicycle comes along and people of all social classes and races have access to this, then there's this kind of fear that, these social classes are going to mix and people are going to marry people. My daughter might meet and marry someone that I don't approve of. So there was that challenge and that fear. And in addition, there was concern about the health effects of the bicycle, because people, apart from people who had to have physical jobs, people who were either farmers, worked in factories, those are people who often worked way too hard for their bodies and tired out very young. But people who did not have to do that kind of physical labor had the other health issue, which is that they were very idle. They didn't go very far. They, particularly women, again, who had to wear constraining clothes because of what was expected of them, very tight corsets and very, very heavy skirts, which could a middle-class woman's getup could weigh 25 pounds. There was this common belief that exercise was not good for you, that it would wear you out, and that the more activity you did, basically the sooner your life force would be expended, and then you would die. And so that was a concern. There were doctors saying, oh, you shouldn't ride the bicycle, you shouldn't ride it hard enough to, if you ride so hard that you get out of breath, then, you're basically asking to die. And what people experienced when they started riding these bicycles for themselves was that actually exercise made them feel better. It made them feel stronger. And so all of these warnings from the medical establishment that literally that riding a bicycle would cause heart disease, it would cause Graves disease, it would cause, epilepsy. People started experiencing what exercise really does for you, and they realized, well, these warnings are not correct. So the bicycle itself kind of responded to some of these concerns that people had.
You mentioned Graves' disease, and one of the symptoms of Graves' disease is where the eyes take on a different appearance, where you can see more of the whites. There's such a funny image of where one of these doctors is trying to demonstrate what can go wrong with your eyes. The idea was that in order to keep your balance and go fast, you'd have to open your eyes wide, and they'd get kind of stuck.
Yes, the dreaded bicycle face. So this was a medical concern that people, after they rode the bicycle, because it was so hard to balance, and it was so worrisome to ride around this way, so fast, right, all by yourself, that your face would basically get stuck the way, you know, with this worried expression on it, and that it would never, that they said, well, we can tell if you've ever ridden a bicycle because your face will clearly have this sort of distorted look.
You know, it seems so ludicrous now, and yet these ideas about health. I actually knew somebody who was an elderly individual who was of the opinion that we had a finite number of breaths that we could take in life, and that you should breathe slowly and infrequently so that you would just stretch your life out. And so I can kind of see how this might happen. Do you suppose, though, that the social revolution going on here might have been behind some of these claims about, you know, damaged health?
Yes. I mean, there was clearly no medical evidence for a lot of this. So it was the doctors were concerned about trying to keep control of, what people did. A doctor at that point, this was at the beginning of modern medical science. They were just discovering that germs cause disease. They were just figuring out a lot of the things that go on with the body. And part of a doctor's role at that time was not only as a health consultant, but as a moral consultant. So doctors expected to be able to tell you not just what was good for your body, but what was good for your spirit. And they felt threatened by this device that was going against what they were saying.
Well, good for the body, good for the spirit. The naysayers who are going to contest that. There were also people who were very worried about children. I'd love to hear you tell us about why kids should have stayed off bicycles.
Well, a lot of them were for the same reasons that they, it was bad for their physical development. And also, at the time when these medical warnings were coming out, there weren't really many bicycles that were made for children. It was still, a very elite adult pursuit. So I wrote in my book a little bit about this group of performing children in the circus who rode these high-wheeled bikes. But of course, they were little because they were little children, but the New York Society for the Prevention of Child Abuse, I'm not sure I'm getting that name exactly right, they actually swore out a warrant for the arrest of P.T. Barnum, who had these children riding these high-wheel bicycles in his show because he was endangering them.
One of the things that I find just fascinating is the idea that I want to go back to the gendered business of whether or not women should have been on bicycles and who was saying they could or couldn't, and women's views themselves, Susan B. Anthony, all of this. At some point, there was a notion that a woman could go on a bicycle without chaperonage. That seems counterintuitive to the times.
Well, it was, and there were people that were arguing against it. This was a time when a proper girl couldn't go on a date without a chaperone, even to a place that was public. Like if you went to on a date to a restaurant, your aunt should come along for it to be proper. But there was an exclusion to that rule, which was you were allowed to ride horses. It was proper because, again, you'd have to be a rich person to ride a horse. So if you were going on a horse ride with somebody, the presumption was that that person was of the same elite social class and that made it okay. And what happened practically with bicycles was that there were moralists saying, well, if a young woman goes out on a bicycle with a young man, there should be a chaperone. But practically, the chaperone would be a much older lady usually, and not necessarily somebody who would be able to keep up on a bicycle. So it was possible to go on a date with a chaperone and end up without the chaperone. So that's the practical part. But then, you know, the societal part was that there was already this exception for horses, and the bicycle was seen as, you know, a poor man's horse, or what would, could be a replacement of the horse, or the mechanical horse, the name of my book. And so they, the morals just kind of developed that even though it was still necessary for a chaperone to go along with you if you went, you know, to a restaurant or to the fair, if you went on a bike ride, it was okay to go without a chaperone.
Well, I want to just go with lightning speed now forward, as you may or may not have answers for us about where we're headed with bicycles. I know that The Mechanical Horse, your book, How the Bicycle Reshaped American Life, I really think the bicycle is still shaping American life and will change it in ways to come as we go forward. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I have thoughts. They're probably, you know, no more valid than anyone else's thoughts. I can tell you what is going on with in cities right now with bicycles is that there are these two kind of countervailing forces. So there are people advocating for protected bike lanes, places where it's safe for cyclists of all ages to ride. You can look at some European cities, and you know, in the Netherlands, for example, and see places where the bicycle is just, you know, very prevalent, and it keeps the city quiet, it keeps the air clean, it keeps people in good health, and there are there are people in the United States advocating for this. On the other hand, we're a very car-centric culture. There are a lot of places where you really can't conduct your life right now without a car, especially if you have a family and you need to get multiple people to the same place at the same time. And so there's political pressure to, as soon as a bicycle lane is added, there's political pressure to remove it, and so that's happening. And then at the same time, we've got in the cities not only things like Uber and Lyft, but the prospect of autonomous vehicles coming. And so there would be, you know, cars driving around with no driver, whether those would be kind of like a taxi or whether they would be private cars. And so the question then becomes, are those going to be devices that accommodate pedestrians and bicycles in the road? Are they going to be, you know, blend in with slower traffic? Or are they going to be programmed and regulated in such a way that the roads become too dangerous for bicycles to share with them?
Margaret Gurov is author of The Mechanical Horse, How the Bicycle Reshaped American Life. Muhammad Ali would never have floated like a butterfly or stung like a bee were it not for Drew Bundini Brown. Ali called him Bodini. We're going to hear about this charismatic figure on Monday here on the show. Join us then. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.